Hello and welcome to another episode of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB and of course on our podcast. I'm Aidy Packham and we're, well, looking for something to do this weekend in association with oldfootballshirts.com. Yes, that's right, for the second weekend in a row we have seen our game called off because of COVID. And in fact, we actually tried to get Wednesday's game against Wolverhampton for the same reason. Most of us will wish that we'd been successful as the shot-shy Seagulls failed to bother the scorers and Wolves went home all 3 points. So then, where does that leave us for the rest of the Christmas fixtures? A lot of people stay away on Wednesdays and people's increasing concerns about the virus combined with Boxing Day's ridiculous kickoff time could see the Amex almost as empty as it was during lockdown. Joining me today as we discuss all of this and more is Alan Wares, and we are delighted to welcome back journalist, author, musician and all-round good bloke, Nick Trepanic. And welcome back to the show, Nick. It's like it's a bit of a sense of deja vu, really, isn't it?
Very much so. On many levels. Thanks. I don't know. I mean, that Wolves game, just... You look forward to, you know, to actually seeing the team play after the Spurs game was off. And then, unfortunately, you do see the team play and not a great night on many levels. So, it's what good is to be taken out of it. We had a view of our squad strength. We've got a big squad, but... have we got a squad that's deep in the right areas? That's the question. I mean, we were not short of midfield players, despite all the suspensions and the absences. But and we still had two, you know, some good quality midfield players on the bench. But just lack of depth in the right areas. You know, the striker that's been spoken about before, and I think we were exposed on against Wolves, weren't we?
Okay, we're going to come and talk about the fixture pile-up and stuff in a minute, but I mean, it was a very frustrating night at the Amex. It was a very empty Amex from what a lot of people there's a lot of concerns at the moment about this new strain of COVID, and it was just...
What you've got, AD, is you've got a slight perfect storm brewing here. You've got something that was brought in during the summer, the whole ticket exchange thing, the Albion Plus, and as soon as I've never used it, I'm a little bit confused as to how it does work in the first place. 25 quid, 15 quid, whatever it is, and you've got to be a member in order to transfer your ticket. The point is, it's not straightforward, and us fans like things simple and straightforward and as idiot-proof as possible, because, you know, in certain cases, you have to appeal to the lowest common denominator. But that's not necessarily the only reason as to why it wasn't an empty Amex. I mean, you saw an awful lot of blue seats, of course you did. But what you've got is you tie in with the fear of this new COVID strain, plus it's winter, plus, I mean, there's still people are coming out of the fact that we must bear in mind that this thing has been with us for a long time and people aren't necessarily being able to earn the kind of money that they were because of restrictions still placed, albeit nominally, on the nature of their jobs. And when you've got that right on top of Christmas, which, you know, by the sounds of things, the cash deals are ringing quite happily, but that's because last year we didn't really get a Christmas that we'd all be used to. These things kind of build up. They're all small things that kind of build up. And I think that football ends up being a little bit of a, well, even more of a TV reality programme. So that combined with the fact that, you know, stable doors and banjos and cows' backsides are still playing at left back and right back and up front for us, it does create for a little bit of our own perfect storm of not everyone. But then having said that, we're far from the only club that's actually suffering this.
Yeah. But I mean, Nick, I mean, is that the case that, I mean, people were because of this current situation, the fact that it was on TV, that they did decide to stay home?
Well, if you're a regular reader of a well-known fan message board, I mean, there were threads, you know, about who's going tonight and, you know, what are you staying away? And possibly more than might have been expected normally. And you know, it's very easy to see why people might be extra concerned, you know, because of the you know, extreme mixed messaging from the government, the uncertainty, and frankly, you know, the number of people who are still refusing to play the game and you know, get vaccinated and get and wear masks and protect everybody. I can see that there's a lot of understandable nerves about that. I mean, I think that one of the problems, of course, that affects the Albion more than anybody else is the transport issue. You know, if you've got a parking space or you can walk to the Amex, well and good. But, you know, if you've got to get on a crowded bus or a crowded train or you don't want to, you know, go very, very early to avoid that, then there are issues around that. And I can fully understand. I mean, the last time I took a train back from the Amex was after the Leeds game. And a very crowded carriage. And I think I counted three people wearing masks. I've had COVID. I don't recommend it to anyone. But there seem to be an awful lot of people who still don't seem to think that it can possibly happen to them. And you just wonder what goes through people's heads in that stage.
No, I mean, the club did put out the message that there was going to be issues with the transport prior to the game. And in fact, when I got into Brighton, just before 6 o'clock, and the queue an hour and a half before kickoff was actually going out past the Queen's Head by Brighton Station. It was actually over the road. It was, and that was, you don't normally see that until about an hour, 45 minutes before the kickoff, before it really gets that big. Because there's trains being cancelled, there's short formations. It was just ridiculous.
We've got the issues that we had 4, 5, 6 years ago with Southam playing City Buggers. And we've got the same problem, is a shortage of staff. Now, once upon a time, they used to call it a temporary shortage of staff, but we all knew, and to quote Nick, let's not play politics. Actually, yes, let's play politics. It's a deliberate understaffing of Southam, which hitherto has been sort of kind of swept under the carpet until such time as things are needed properly being done. So we've got a shortfall of staff here. Now, as it transpires, I made a point of coming in earlier from Goring-by-Sea. And my train in was absolutely fine and dandy, and it wasn't packed, and it was good. Admittedly, I'd left at 10 to 5 to get into Brighton, and it was fine. But as you and I know, because we've got the same train on the way back, AD, it was what a palaver it was getting home. Now, you know, it's they are extra trains that club puts on from Falmer, but they were being cancelled arbitrarily. Now, it's not as bad as the Aston Villa, that Aston Villa game from our promotion season. So we're talking about back end of 2016, November 2016. That's 5 years ago, where Southern just decided, we're not going to put any trains on tonight. Good luck with that. And we had a complete mess. Now, you know, it was different for you and I. We got the bus back to the sort of into Brighton. And it's good that we have this. It's brilliant that we have this option of the public transport thing and we can get there and it's not a problem. But even then, our late night train was done and it helps no one. Now, we could rant about this and you've got to realise that the Albion can do nothing. And if you could actually go back to Southern and say, can you sort it out? Because it's still a mess from 5 years ago and you'll still get nothing because, you know, they're effectively government contractors. So it doesn't help us, but it does also mean it's another reason as to why, you know, we have the notion of... Yeah. You know, empty stadiums.
It's not so bad when you win, though, is it? But when we didn't, and Nick, it was... I'm not going to say it was a lackluster performance because we dominated possession once more, but we didn't create any... Their keeper didn't have a save to make all game. We got ourselves into great positions. And Wolves had one...
Did we, though? Hang on, did we? Did we?
I mean, we had an awful lot of the ball in areas that didn't threaten Wolves at all. And not for the first time, we took so long to get the ball forward that any players who were trying to get into the box were faced with a wall of gold shirts. And this isn't the first time we've seen this. And, you know, this is an old hobby horse of mine, but get the ball forward quicker, cross the ball without taking three touches. I mean, the game at Burnley, we didn't play particularly well. We pulled it out of the fire because of two first-time crosses Between the goalkeeper and the defence that was running back towards its own goal. Given that we had six midfield players and four defenders among our outfield players towards the end, there didn't seem to be any sort of particular plan for using this formation to unlock the defence. But getting, you know, that Lamptey and Cucurella liked to cross the ball first time, that Solly March seemed to have overcome that sort of difficulty in getting the ball in early, but it seemed to be back to his old faults again against Wolves. And just, I think there was a feature on what Everton were doing well at the beginning of the season before they had all their injuries. And a lot of it was down to wide players getting the ball in early, you know, before a defence can set itself. Okay, you know, not every cross is going to land on an Albion head, but you know, it might get a bad deflection off a Wolves player. It might drop for us. Who knows?
Well, the two examples that spring to mind were the otherwise fundamentally appalling, and I have to say this, Jakub Moda, whose corners were amongst the worst I've ever seen. But having said that, when it comes to dead ball stuff, and that thing that you were talking about just now, Nick, of getting the ball in between defenders, that no man's land between the defenders and the goalkeeper, which causes such confusion. He did it twice. He did it brilliantly as a kind of a slight outswinger, I suppose, as you call it. And both times, the loveliest fella on the planet,
yes,
who we had on the show last week, Enoch Mwepu, badly fluffed his lines. Maybe we were a Jonah, who knows, AD, but they were, you know, welcome to the Albion, Enoch, because they were appalling misses again.
Graham Potter is supposed to be an innovative coach, isn't he? And yet I've never really been impressed with our attacking set plays under him. There was one set play late on, wasn't there, where we had three people lined up against him and three people lined up to take a free kick and two ran away and possibly tried to take defenders away, and then one, the third person, crossed it. But you know, you don't see many set plays from us, and you think, "Oh, I haven't seen that before," or "That's unusual." And I just wonder, you know, who is actually looking after attacking set plays on the training ground? Is there something a little bit more inventive that we could do?
Well, there was one early on where Tarek Lamptey had a really good opportunity, which was like a near post corner, that.
Oh yeah, that was that. That's right. That's
had true. Him running onto the ball at pace, which was, and he just put it into the side netting. But that was a good opportunity, and that was obviously straight off the training ground. But yeah, I agree.
I think when it comes to any given set piece, you have to play to the strengths of what your target is. And actually, on Wednesday, we only had one big man, frankly,
and he was taking the corners. Oh no, sorry, Dan Byrne as well.
Yeah, well, we normally have the option of three or four, or certainly two or three. And so, you know, and which is why you could see that Dan Byrne always started outside the area to make the run in. But like I say, it doesn't help. And if you wanted something new, Nick, then I think you did get it, was the quality of Yakimoda's corners, scuttling along the ground and cleared by the first defender. But don't get me wrong, he wasn't the only one to do it. You know, it was almost kind of a standing joke. This free kick slash corner, the slash dead ball is going to hit that first defender. And yeah, you try and get the notion of, yeah, get it in low and flat as best you can, but low and flat still means clearing the first fella. And it means going at 10 feet rather than going at 30 feet.
Was there anybody on the pitch who had the sort of leadership qualities or the stature to just have a go and say to Moda, look, next one that hits the first defender is the last one you're taking tonight. You know, we're going to change this round. I remember playing Sunday League once, and we used to have this big Irishman called Mick Connolly, and he would actually growl at people, and you didn't know what was going to happen if you made another mistake of the thing you'd actually done, but you didn't want to find out. And I just wonder whether, you know, there was a lack of leadership on that pitch the other night, and somebody's, you know, telling some of the players to get a grip, frankly.
Well, the thing is,
there was one or two players. There was one moment. I think it was in the second half when Trossard got so visibly fed up with a teammate that he ran past him to do his job for him. I think you might know who I mean, but I don't want to name names.
Is
anybody, you know, I was telling Ailey before we came on, I've got a picture on my phone as my screensaver of Brian Horton chewing out Paul Clark during a game at West Ham last time we were in the top division, you know? Who's the person who basically gives somebody else in the team a piece of their mind when they're not performing?
It's been a while since it's been someone like Danny Cullip, who, you know, would would chew his teammates. I think it's just one of those malaises of modern football, is you don't actually have open arguments on the pitch. If you're going to be seen to lead, you encourage rather than berate.
Wolves did. There was a couple of moments when a couple of Wolves players went at each other, and possibly that's what they had that we were missing at times.
Maybe.
I mean, Connor Cody is a player that would do that. I still don't think he's better than Lewis. I mean Lewis would probably do it.
Lewis would do it. Adam Lallana will do it.
Someone needs to do it to Adam Lallana.
Well, there's that. But even Bissouma would do it, albeit in a kind of sulky way. But, you know, you see the shoulders drop. You see the petulance that someone's fed up that he didn't get the ball in the right way. But, yeah, I mean, you can't imagine Solly March doing it. But above and beyond that, I mean, Mopay would do it because he'd say, I want this here, I want this there. At the least, you'd have someone who say, give it to me here. Whereas the service, and this is, I think, where the game fell down, was the service. And you mentioned Cucurella and Lamptey just earlier, is that I actually felt that certainly Lamptey, I wouldn't even say he played within himself, but there were times when Italy where he didn't have a huge amount of help, and I think he was just expected to be three players before he got the ball in. But there were times he was almost reluctant to get the ball in. And it brings me back, by the way, to another thing, another one of my bete noirs, and actually I want to get your opinion on this, Nick, as someone who's watched and written about football for so long, is that sometimes Lamptey had the opportunity to get the ball in, albeit with his left foot. Now, why is it that professional footballers cannot use both feet? Of course, one will be stronger than the other, but why can't they do it to a quality that says, right, I've cut in, I'm going to ping this in with my left foot?
Yes, I know. Sometimes you think he's going to, and I mean, so we go back to Solly March. Solly March's shot in the first half, it wasn't a bad shot, actually, with his right foot. But you just got the impression as soon as he was put through in that situation, he kind of really wanted to hit it with his left if he possibly could. And I do remember when writing a fairly well-received promotion book, talking to Solly March about whether he was more comfortable on the right or on the left, and him saying, you know, he wasn't really sure. But I think he's definitely more comfortable on his left foot than on his right. No, I don't know. I don't know what players do in training half the time when they're, you know, when some of them are so reluctant to use what you might call but shouldn't have to call their wrong foot. No, I mean, a two-footed player. I mean, Lallana, I know, worked very hard on being two-footed. There was a French coach that when he was coming through the Southampton youth ranks that he credits with, you know, making players use their wrong foot and learning to be good. And he is effectively two-footed, but he wasn't born that way. He worked at it. And, you know, I just wonder if he's expressing his frustration on the training ground as much as he might with one or two players who aren't as two-footed as he is, because he worked at it, it can be done.
I mean, Adam's come to the club, and one of his remits and one of the reasons he came here was to be take on a more of a coaching role as well. So, I mean, he's more than capable of actually taking these players under his wing at the training ground. So, okay, come on, we can do this.
Well, if you remember during lockdown, and you can hear all the players, I mean, we've all three of us have been in the stadium, and in an empty stadium. One of the booming voices you get to hear is Adam Lallana's.
Yeah, definitely.
Actually, someone who we've mentioned who would actually give everyone a G up, I think, and again, wasn't playing on Wednesday, is Adam Webster.
Mm.
I think he'd have actually torn a new backside off one or two players. Yeah, Lewis Dunk, just because he doesn't scream and shout, but he will actually still give you the eyes, and he'll still should terrify everyone. At least the players you know full well respect Lewis Dunk enough. If he's gonna bellow at you, he's gonna do it properly. But I mean, the weird thing is that for all the fact that we're berating our play, it's just funny enough, the midfield was absolutely superb. I mean, it went through the Wolves midfield for the most part, like a knife through butter, and weirdly enough, can do so most, if not all, midfields in this country. Maybe not Chelsea, maybe not Manchester City, but at least with someone like Liverpool and Arsenal, you feel you're going to get chances. The only times you really don't for me is Chelsea and Man City. So this is a midfield, which arguably, collectively, now it depends whether it's Gross, Mwepu, Bissouma, Lallana, even Alzate, and maybe one or two others I've forgotten, that any combination of them, they work really, really well. Then after that, there seems to be a, I don't know what it is, a lack of communication, a breakdown. This, you know, the number of times that players were on their heels on Wednesday when they should have seen a ball coming. You see them ping, ping, ping it about. And then the last minute, the ball that, you know, that, that's going to set them through doesn't arrive, or it's misplaced.
Out of all of those players you mentioned there, there was, on Wednesday night, there was only one player who was trying to pass the ball forward. Everything was sideways and backwards. And it was our mate Enoch, who was, he didn't have the greatest game, we'll hold our hands up to that, but it's, he was actually doing his head in. Basically, he was trying to play the ball forward every time, and nobody was making the runs forward or looking like they were going to do. So basically, he had to keep passing it sideways, and it was just so, I can understand him getting frustrated. There was one time he completely fluffed his line when Connolly did actually look like he was going to make the run to break the line, and he could have slid in through, and he just slipped. I mean, actually, a lot of players slipped on Wednesday night, but
he just
slipped at the lot when he's playing the ball, and the ball got skied, and he got easily cleared. But that was the only time a player was actually trying to get on the end of something.
Nick, how do you solve a problem like Aaron?
Yeah, just exactly what I was going to come on to next. I've been a big booster of his, a big fan of his. I've relentlessly trotted out the line that he, you know, that he's got it in him. You know, we've seen, it's what they say in the United States, you know, if you display a skill, you own it. You know, once you've done it, we know it's in there, you can do it again. But I've come to the conclusion the worst thing that ever happened to him was scoring those two goals against Tottenham, because it raised expectations. It made it difficult for Potter to take him out of the first team squad, and of course, you know, you think when you've been a member of a Premier League squad for two full seasons, is more now, isn't it? The blow to morale to then loan a player out, especially if he was to go to the Championship, you know, would be a very difficult thing to do. But it's, something's got to happen, because, you know, everything that we saw, you know, the effort, the pace, just seems to be disappearing along with the, you know, the eye for goal. He scored goals at every level. So he, to some degree, is a proven goal scorer. But I just think that, you know, we could be just damaging him by just having him half, you know, the time on the bench and then giving the occasional cameo. You know, it was a great chance for him to show something, but he didn't do it. And he didn't even really look particularly up for it. I don't know if a loan to the Championship was right. I keep saying somewhere in Germany, maybe Spain, Italy, a fresh challenge, something different, but not an obvious downgrade, which could be the last thing he wants. Championship chasing Union Saint-Gilloise in Belgium, maybe. But I'm beginning to give up on Aaron Connolly as somebody to stay in our squad after January for the rest of the season. He needs something else.
I think so. He needs to hit the reset button somewhere down the line, because, like you say, yeah, I fully agree with you. Those two, I think it's not just raised expectations for the Albion fans. It maybe even raised expectations for him. I mean, it's a dream.
Oh, yeah, I mean, you hear about him. You hear about from other players mentioning the two goals he scored against Tottenham. I'm afraid he's got to forget all about those until he scores some more goals for the first team.
Absolutely. No,
he didn't get on the pitch, but it was the first time in a first team squad, which was Evan Ferguson. And let's just hope we don't hype him up as much as we did with Aaron.
No, but I don't know if you're a regular watchers of the under 23s games, but no, he seems to be a great presence, and for his youth, he seems unbelievably confident. As they say, quick feet for a big man, and he is a big man. And you know, he's got that other side to his game. We've seen him score headers, you know, great shots after, you know, tricky runs. He seems to have a fantastic range, and you can understand them wanting to sort of nurture him and take it, you know, slowly and steadily, and not rush him. But you know, he would appear to be, you know, an immensely promising talent, one of many in the under-23s. And I just wonder, you know, if we're going to look at Ryan Longman, we look at Reda Kadri, we look at Van Hek scoring that fantastic goal for Blackburn at Bournemouth, you know, and you're wondering if where Connolly might be if he'd had that sort of experience. The next logical thing I'm saying there is that Ferguson will go out on loan somewhere. But, you know, are we bristling with attacking talent to the extent that we can afford to let that happen?
Yeah. But hang on, AD, therein lies the point, and this is admittedly a discussion we had afterwards, and I want...
Yeah, we fell out.
I didn't fall out. I just pointed out something that I think you way, way, way over-bloated and over-promoted, because he's, what, 16, 17 years old, and he is a big old lump, and he does have, you know, something about him. But you have to remember that, A, he's playing against people his own age, his own, all right, maybe people 2 or 3 years older, but he's playing against people. And that is a vast, vast, vast difference between that and the Premier League. So we've got that about him. And the reason, the answer you gave was, well, what about Michael Owen? What about Wayne Rooney?
What about James Milner? What about, I can't remember the guy, what's the guy at Dortmund's name?
Yeah, but you look at these players and you see that these players are world class at 16. Now, Evan Ferguson would have to shine so much more brightly for the under 23s that he'd actually be ripping up that league and he'd be on 30, 35 goals already. And of course, it doesn't necessarily, that's the only way to judge him. But if you're going to have someone who is that high up, is ready to make that leap at the age of 16 or 17. And at the moment, we don't have that. We have something about him where he does very well in his age group. And therefore, that is a talent to nurture.
He's still above his age group, though, isn't he? You say 16, 17, but he's playing in the under 21, under 23s. If he was on the bench and we were 3-0 up or 3-0 down, he could give him 5 or 10 minutes at the end and have a look at him in that situation. We haven't had that luxury or that problem.
Yeah, no, there is that, of course. And I think that probably if, and it is an almighty if you are going to blood him, then you're probably your next best option is the cup match against West Brom. Now, I'm not even sure, did Ferguson play in the auto trophy games against those league sides?
Didn't he come on in the game at Swansea?
At Cardiff, he did.
Cardiff, yeah, that's right. Yeah. He came on late in that game.
Yeah, so but I think what it is that people were clamouring, and this is what actually really drives me around the twist, is clamouring him for him to start just because the rest of our forwards are misfiring. And we're back to your argument here, Nick, that if you blood him and it doesn't go as well as you'd hoped, then that can actually have serious repercussions, you know, further down the line. So it's not a case of trying...
Blooding in the sense of
getting him on there.
The thing is that Connolly pretty much became an established member of the squad, didn't he? And after those two goals against Tottenham, I don't think he scored again until the last game of the season away to Burnley.
Yeah. Yeah, and he's still expected to be a first-choice striker. So yeah,
Al, this is a conversation we wouldn't even be having if it wasn't for Graham Potter being the manager, because if Graham thinks he's good enough and he's able to make the step up, he wouldn't have included him in the squad because I know we're low in numbers. And I'm not saying, oh yeah, you know, I was just using those names as an example of players that have stepped up. We're they did it at bigger clubs than Brighton. So and they were clearly world class talents. We don't know how good this guy is going to be. He can end up like crashing and burning, or he could go on and be a shining star. We're hoping it's the latter. But Graham, if he thinks he's good enough, we'll give him the opportunity.
Well, yes, he will.
He's not looking at his birth certificate.
No, absolutely. But my point is that he was on the bench probably because we are so low on numbers. Other than that, he's on the bench. I've seen people berating Potter for not putting him on the bench. When you've got so much more of the first team midfield ahead of him who are fit and ready, of that, what is it? I've lost track. 20 people that they can pick. Ferguson wouldn't necessarily be one of those on there. He's on there, basically. Of the first team, officially first team players, we didn't have 20 people ready. So it's a promotion to get him on the bench. Of that bench on the Wednesday, I'd have said that 5 of that 9 had no chance in getting on.
Well, we're going to have a bit of a
Taylor
break
Richards
now anyway.
Got on, so, I don't really know what he contributed.
Well, he's played before in the first team and probably a good half a dozen games. And yeah, I thought he contributed some neat and tidiness, but you know, and had a go. It probably, as AD said, like Mwepu, one of the few players that actually tried to pass it forward, as opposed to trying to go skirt round the Wolves' defence. But I think by that time, the writing was on the wall. And it's not as though I don't think Taylor Richards was poor or didn't do himself any favours. I think it was okay, but I say I think it was just
another he's just another of that large sort of platoon of slightly, you know, creative-y sort of midfield players, much of a muchness.
Yeah.
Of which we have a multitude.
Yes.
Well, we're going to talk about the fact that we've got no game this weekend in a minute, so the players are going to get a break. And so are we, because it's time to listen to the Albion Roar on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. As usual, we've got a fabulous shirt of the week for you, which Nick is going to describe for us right now.
I am. I'll just get my phone around the right way. It's essentially a basic black with rather fetching sky blue and sort of grey, I don't know what you call them, flecks or sort of horizontal stripes.
Slashes,
yeah, slashes is good. And the sponsor is Bijou's. Now, do they sponsor Indian cricket?
You're asking.
That was my clue gone then.
So I was thinking, I don't recognise the Maker's logo at all. And something's come out of the team crest. But I was going to guess that it was something subcontinental.
Well, you were in the right country when you were mentioned. The sponsor is Indian. Absolutely correct, and it is an Indian side. And here's what Phil has to say about this particular jersey.
Don't I get to guess?
Oh, you can have a guess if you want.
Okay, it's an Indian side.
Yes, it is.
Chennai. I'm going to throw it out there. Chennai.
Chennai Super Kings. And no, it's not. Oh no, Chennai Super Kings are T20 side, aren't they?
No, they're a brand of cigarettes.
He said, here is your shirt of the week and one of the most recent additions to my personal collection, says Phil. Chosen well because, well, I'm making a curry tonight for dinner. This is the 2021 away shirt of Indian Super League side Kerala Blasters, and they are nicknamed the Manjapada, which translates to be the Yellow Army, and they play at the Jawaharlal Nehru International Stadium, also known as the Kalor Stadium. When the stadium opened in 1996, a match between India and Iraq attracted a crowd in excess of 100,000. The authorities decided that this was an unsafe number, and the capacity has since been restricted to just 39,000 Super League matches.
That's quite a slash.
The stadium is noted as the fifth loudest stadium in the world after a match between the Kerala Blasters and Atletico de Kolkata in 2016, where the noise level was recorded at 128 decibels. The side was formed in 2014 for the inaugural Indian Super League season and have rapidly become one of the most supported clubs in India, and with the largest social media following of any club in Asia. Their fans, also known as the Manjapada, and they pack out stadiums for both home and away matches, and they're known as the Yellow Sea, as they wear bright yellow and wave yellow flags, yellow being regarded as the colour of determination and faith, according to their former co-owner, Sachin Tendulkar. The current squad is made up largely Indian players, although they have got a Bosnian goalkeeper and three South Americans in the side too. Defender Sandash Jinghan holds the record for the most appearances, playing 76 league matches between 2014 and 2020, and also has 40 caps for India. Links to the UK include David James, who played 12 times in goal for them in 2014 before hanging up his gloves. Wimbledon and Man City legend Terry Phelan managed the cyber team in 2015 and 2016. Michael Chopra, Wes Brown, Peter Ramage, Dimitar Berbatov have all earned a living on the subcontinent playing for the Blasters. And of course, there's an Albion link for you. Defender Aaron Hughes had a brief spell with Brighton in 2014, making 10 appearances before heading down under and then on to Kerala. And not one, but two managerial links for you. For Peter, Mr. Grimsdale, Taylor managed the side in the 2015 side season, and Steve Coppell took the reins in 2016 when they ran up as runners-up in the ISL. And Phil Haas says, Merry Christmas, everyone. And to you, Phil. And
sorry, AD, just a quick question. What's the reference to Mr. Grimsdale when you're talking about Peter Taylor?
Well,
oh, God, no.
That's
Norman Wisdom.
Of his Norman Wisdom impression, yeah.
Did he do? Is that what he did?
Notorious for it.
Yeah. I missed it. Thankfully, I missed it.
You didn't miss much.
Oh, good.
At least Norman Wisdom's a famous
former Albion director. Bit was. I didn't realise that Peter Taylor did an impersonation of him. Phil was really enjoying himself there, wasn't he?
Yeah. Well, I mean, obviously, that's from, you can go and see the shirt. We'll be on all our socials, but it'll also be on the oldfootballshirts.com, where there's over 120,000 shirts of many different colours and varieties for you to have a look at. And it's always a good place to go to check some stuff out.
And just a quick community note for you here. Obviously, this is the last Albion Raw before Christmas. We're not going to put one out on Christmas Day because, frankly, you'll all be too squiffy on your Bucks Fizz and your prawn cocktails to start Christmas Day on. So we're not going to put out a new show, but we will have a shirt of the year for the end of year show, which we intend to get the band back together for. So I think probably just a quick thank you to everyone who's taken part in the Raw this year. We'll probably do our bigger thanks next week. But so we'll have another shirt of the week for the next show, which will be shirt of the year. But talking of T-shirts, AD.
Yeah, talking of those, last week we had a competition on the show we did with Enoch Wepu from our good friends over at Art of Football. They also have many, many, many great designs, some of which we've had a hand in, some of which we most definitely haven't. But I mean, there's a good Albion range and there's a lot of stuff that I really recommend. Their Dali designs, they're particularly good. But we had a competition to give away a voucher for the Art of Football website, so you can get yourself a T-shirt or give it to somebody as a Christmas present or whatever. And we asked a question now.
And the question was, bearing in mind we had Enoch Wepu on the show, who scored a great goal at Anfield. We drew the match 2-2, so who scored the Albion's second goal? The correct answer, Nick, was...
Leandro Trossard.
It was indeed. And we had a multitude of correct answers. And Adrian...
From all over the world, actually. So I should... We had a few entries from Zambia. Can't think why that might be.
Okay.
And a few from New Zealand, a couple from Australia. It was one from America. It was a worldwide competition.
So who could you now give out the name of the winner?
I think I'm going to leave this one to you, Al. We did the draw earlier.
We did do the draw earlier in the presence of Nick. But congratulations, Paul Gagan, who is from...
He's from the UK.
Oh, thank you for that. That means that any T-shirt he buys will get there a lot quicker and not get stuck at customs. So congratulations to Paul there. Well done. It just saves us saves Art of Football a few quid and a few months of misery while their T-shirt gets stuck at the port. But thanks for taking part, and we'll have another competition another day. AD.
I should point out that it's not just T-shirts, which I do. They do some fabulous prints as well. And they've got, like I said earlier, they've got some really, really good stuff on there. So it's well worth going on there, onto their website, which is www.art-of-football.com, and having a look and seeing what they do. And like I said, we're going to be designing a T-shirt for the next year. So that'll be good news. So we're going into the Christmas period, Nick. Normally, traditionally, one where there's a lot of fixture congestion. We're not going to have that this year, which is not by design, but because, we've had two games called off because of COVID. We could have had a third. We applied to have the Wolves game called off because we were decimated with it. and everything. And for some reason, they decided that Man United can do it, but Brighton can't.
Of course, you know, if the Wolves game had been off, we would have been denied the sight of my new least favourite Premier League club, which is Wolves. Every time I've seen them, they've wasted time, they've feigned injury, they've play-acted, you know, they've thrown themselves at the turf with monotonous regularity. And funnily enough, as soon as they go behind in the game, this all stops. if I don't see Wolves again all season, it'll be too soon. And I don't know if this is a Bruno Lage thing, but it didn't seem to happen in previous seasons. This season, it's happened every time I've seen them. Anyway,
say, are you suggesting they're managed by Sam Allardyce or Neil Warnock, by any chance?
Let's talk about the upcoming fixtures. Yeah, it'll be nice. I think we saw on Wednesday that we need some of our injured and ill players back. So if we've got a nice gap now, that could be a good thing. And if equally some of the Spurs and Manchester United games are played quite well into the new year, when we've got something much closer to a full squad, I don't think that's a bad thing. I don't know. Brentford, are they a sort of team we want to play against? The team that worries me is Chelsea. They've been stuttering and their manager's been grizzling about being unable to hold leads and everything like that, and dropped another point to Everton. You just think, oh God, you know, and here we come to break up that bad run of theirs. let's hope we can go to Stamford Bridge and do at least what we did last season and take them on at their own game. You know, obviously we should, but I feel that Chelsea's run of bad luck there or their habit of giving away the lead is just going to end there. Because of course, if we'd have to score a goal to take the lead back from them.
Yeah. But I mean, Nick, I mean that's assuming the game's actually going to take place. I mean,
of course.
The whole Christmas calendar could be decimated, and that is not going to be. I mean, it could be almost like a dress rehearsal for the World Cup next year.
A World Cup, of course, which should never be happening. And I think all the hoops that that football is jumping through to fit this Qatar World Cup in are utterly disgraceful. Remember that part of the condition of them actually getting that World Cup was that they would be played in summer as usual, and they'd be able to air condition the stadiums. As soon as they said that couldn't be done, the World Cup should have been taken away from them immediately. I'm just not looking forward to next season at all on many levels. You know that the football world should have to rip itself, you know, and twist itself into knots to allow for this frankly criminal enterprise is just an utter disgrace.
Norway's already pulled out, isn't it? Or is threatening to pull out.
I think you get Gareth Southgate saying, oh, well, I need to educate myself. You know, I need to... What's the problem? You know, he's supposedly a well-rounded individual. He should already know exactly what's going on. He's been over there. It needs a serious country that's a potential World Cup winner to say, no, we're not going. I would so love that to be England, but it won't be, of course.
No. And the weird thing is that so many Western European countries are ready to step up and take it on at a moment's notice, even if it was during the summer. And I'd imagine, well, a few first world countries. I mean, you know, what is Australia going to do to, even though it's, you know, it might be a palaver for Europe, but what does Australia have to do to host it?
I said long ago that all the major countries should pull out or send an under 21 team into the World Cup and have a tournament of their own in the United States, which was the country that should have hosted it, which would have been the proper winner. Even Sepp Blatter voted for the United States, and he was amazed. He was stunned by the cynicism and corruption of his fellow FIFA members when the name of Qatar came out. They should have just had a sort of alternative World Cup and then said to the decent the proper football countries, come along and play in this, or don't bother looking to us for any help in the future.
But even then, they've watered down the next World Cup after that. It's going to be in Canada, USA and Mexico. Yeah. And that was bad enough when it was in America that the two closest teams, the two closest cities were 250 miles apart. But then you've got this across this entire continent. And if nothing else, Euro 2020 played this year, shown us what a farce it can be, especially in terms of, you know, when you consider COP26 that happened at the beginning of November, and people flying into this. You know, we've got an entire continent of extra fans, extra planes flying everywhere. It's a World Cup that actually is, well, two World Cup tournaments that are so set so far outside almost reality.
Well, you know that the two groups of people who are be the last to be considered are the players followed by the fans.
Yeah.
You know, and that's true of UEFA and FIFA, and both those bodies just need severe looking. I mean, you know, to have a review of football to cover this country is one thing, but there needs to be a review of world football.
Talking of which, actually, I mean, let's look ahead 9 years, because the 2030 World Cup hasn't been decided yet. Now, there's two, I think, main contenders, irrespective of what went on earlier this year. Where would you say, maybe heart versus head, of the two main contenders that seem to be there, would you prefer to have it? A UK-based one, i.e. we invented football, or because it's the centenary of the first World Cup, back in Uruguay, which Uruguayans have said, admittedly, they can't host it on their own. They want Argentina to be in with them, which is fair enough. So of those two, would you like to have it in South America or back home? Or do you still see that it should be a third new player in?
Well, but it shouldn't be in the Americas, should it? By rights, because you'll have been in the United States, Canada. So it should be back in the Eastern Hemisphere, shouldn't it? It should be back in the first world. So I suppose, well, you say irrespective of what happened earlier this year, but I mean, how irrespective can it be? You know, surely what happened at Wembley in that European final, if people are paying attention, should rule us out for a very long time.
Mm.
So I mean, you know, no, people didn't die, but that was more good luck than judgment.
Yeah, it certainly wasn't pretty, was it? And I mean, it's just, I don't know. I mean, the whole international football thing. I mean, there's so many other countries that deserve to actually host it who have never hosted it, and there's so many countries that are capable. I mean, Al mentioned Australia. I mean, they had this at the World Cup in South Africa, but they could quite easily have it in another African country. Canada is quite capable of hosting it on its own. Why can't you just have it in one continent? It's just seems
Greece and Turkey. How about that?
Country, oh, sorry. What could go wrong?
I mean, if they can have it in Qatar, they can quite obviously have it in the Arctic or the Antarctic. You know, they just borrow Leicester's snow blowers and they'll be all right.
Yeah. Well, they have had it in Sweden before, so, and they've had it in Russia before, but. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of interesting. The Middle East is far too dangerous. Wouldn't it be nice to think that, you know, you could have a football tournament there? And actually, even if it was just, never mind. Anyway, but yeah, I mean, China is probably capable of hosting it. Whether you'd want to go there or not is another matter, but China's capable of hosting it. Australia, again, a first world country, perfectly capable of hosting it. Probably the vast majority of European countries, if they were so minded, probably could host it. So, yeah, it would be nice to have somewhere new and somewhere appropriate. I mean, we thought at the time the Russian one, you know, thinking, well, you know, was that Moody money that paid for it? But at least you know that Russia has a very good, well-established football history, and so therefore probably did deserve to host it. You know,
are you suggesting that Qatar doesn't have a football history out?
Well, that's my point, and this is everyone's point. I mean, you know, at least with the Russia, because when Russia and Qatar were announced at the same time. At least the Russia one had a semblance of
there was a shred of credibility about that.
Yes, yes, and Qatar one on basically every single level. I mean, you know, it's that's not to say that just because a country doesn't have a football pedigree, it shouldn't host it. I think that's unfair. However, somewhere that's appropriate climactically, if nothing else,
North Africa, Morocco, and Algeria.
Yeah, they've got reasonable football pedigrees. Yeah. And apart from the fact of West Germany against Austria in 1982, yes. Algeria would have had a superb World Cup record.
Mm. Well, okay, well, that's something for us to consider, particularly next year when Christmas is going to be just after the World Cup. But, I mean, we are heading headlong into Christmas, and that means we're heading headlong into January. Whether the fixtures take place or not between now and January, I mean, obviously, we're meant to have 11 games in December, we've only got two left.
at the moment.
But AD, I mean, the transfer window is coming up.
The thing about that is, AD, that, you know, is that it is going to help, I think, possibly, moodily, it's going to help us because if, for all the teams that are having their fixtures cancelled, their fixtures postponed, the big ones will still be in the cup competitions towards the end of the season when those rearranged fixtures have to be played. Some of them will still be in Europe. They'll have a fixture pile up. They're going to get the hump with it. But, you know, there's a couple of extra... there is not a huge amount of wiggle room in the Premier League and the UEFA football calendar from August to May to actually put new or rearranged fixtures in. They don't actually have that much wiggle room these days.
Well, it just becomes a championship season then, doesn't it? Because, I mean, look, if you look at the championship, they're playing Saturday, Tuesday, Wednesday every week pretty much at the moment. And it's like... It is. I mean, and as Nick said, the players are probably the last people to be considered in this but it's them who are putting their bodies on the line. And it's them who's going to have the injuries affect them.
Yes, but my point is that that some clubs also have the extra European stuff as well, and those bigger clubs are more likely to be, you know, because we still have the FA Cup. It's still going to be that fourth and fifth rounds are going to be midweek. That's not helping anyone at all either.
Trouble is that when our games are rearranged, Manchester United, obviously, we hope they. That game's rearranged between a couple of Champions League rounds. But Tottenham, I think, managed to eliminate themselves from Europe, didn't they, by unilaterally calling off that that game. Yeah. So that won't affect us. And, we'll have to see how it goes. It's going to be hard, isn't it? Because lots of other people have had games against, you know, that they're going to be rearranged against teams not in Europe. And... I mean, I hope you're right. I hope your analysis is proved correct. But, let's see. I mean, there's a long way to go before.
Well, Nick, I mean, you know, if they have got a fixed pile up, it gives us a good opportunity to actually take the competition seriously and try and win it, right?
Absolutely, yes. Anyway. We'll see what sort of team that is put out at West Brom.
Okay. Well, that will be after once January's started. And obviously, started to say there that the window is opening in January. We do need some fresh. I know that Tony doesn't like the January window very much, but you know it's quite obvious what we need, isn't it?
But I tend to agree with Graham Potter that, you know, the trouble is that money doesn't guarantee you anything. You know, if you could pick and choose who you would sign, you know, who is the that guarantees you new goals? I mean, everyone's saying, oh, we should have signed Ivan Toney. How many goals has he got? Four, isn't it? Most of them penalties. Fewer than Neil Mopay. It's a very risky game to play, even with somebody else's money. You know, the idea that we should buy a striker. I mean, people are saying we should get some of the guys from Union in Belgium over, you know, not withstanding the idea that we'd be robbing one of Toney's other teams of a possible title to prop ourselves up. But yet we've seen people coming from the Belgian top league before and not being such a great success. Difficult. If there was a magic silver bullet, I think Tony would have fired it by now.
Yeah. But I mean, are you looking at the exit door though? Do you think, I mean, there are players that who would have hoped to have had more minutes this year that haven't necessarily been given the opportunities. I mean, Alexis McAllister won.
I like McAllister. You know, I think he's capable of playing in that true number 10 role. You know, he's the guy who looks for the forward pass. He can shoot. You know, he's got a decent set play on him. Yet Graham Potter has had chances to start him and doesn't seem to think he's quite the right man. We've, you know, a lot of forums have discussed the Andone situation. Graham Potter obviously doesn't consider him as somebody who's going to contribute. I'm not optimistic about us making a signing in January because, as you say, I just don't think Tony Bloom sees value there. He doesn't seem to believe in the loan system. I think we are looking for Danny Welbeck to come back and be fit and it may be just that.
But Danny has been a massive miss for us, hasn't he? I mean,
oh, yeah.
I mean, the way, I mean, this is, I mean, someone like Danny against Wolves on someone who stretches the game and actually runs at people.
Absolutely. We haven't got,
and take on players. It's
well, if you think about the big Bob Sanchez almost assist with that long ball down the middle for Welbeck at Crystal Palace, which should have ended up in a penalty for us. Yeah, as you say, that stretching of the game, you know, that out ball for Sanchez to play those long kickouts or long throwouts to someone like, there's nobody else. I think Connolly could do it. I think Connolly probably has the pace to do it, but does he, you know, does he look for that run? You know, was he really looking for those runs on Wednesday? I think he'll give us a lot when he comes back, but then there's always that fear that, you know, there's another injury lurking around the corner.
Yeah. I mean, Connolly's a sniffer. He wants it in and around the 6-yard box, but he's not. Is he an unselfish player?
He can run in behind. He's got the pace. You remember when we played Liverpool a couple of seasons ago when he was put clean through? He's got the pace to get in behind. It's what he does with it after that that's possibly the problem.
Yeah, I mean, when you say, I mean, it's interesting. He comes across as a 6-yard sniffer, and he certainly was when he was playing in the under 23s, absolutely. But so is Neil Mopay. And Mopay usually, not always, but usually has the, a bit like Murray, has the wherewithal about him as to when to dart in front of the, well, Welbeck certainly does, but, you know, when to dart in front of the defender, or when to sort of like pull back on that space. You see it in bits and pieces with Connolly, but you also get to realise that when he sees the ball coming in, there's an air of him being a bit sometimes too reactive rather than proactive. Mm. You know, he should be screaming at the providers as to where he wants it. Sometimes he does. But when it comes to that ball in the air, and you're talking about being a 6-yard sniffer, sometimes his position can be a little bit wanting.
Well, I think it's fair to say that... I think it's fair to say, Al, that all that Graham wants for Christmas is for a striker or one of his strikers to be hitting the target on a more regular basis. But it is Christmas. What would you get Graham for Christmas, Nick?
I don't know. I think, you know, a few more of those outfits that you know, to vary it and see if, you know, a change of outfit has sometimes brought a change of luck. Probably it's time for a new look. Ralph Hasenhüttl went for the Sound of Music look, didn't it? And Southampton won a few games, so maybe, so a Peaky Blinders look for his Brummy roots or something.
I mean, Al still wants to get him a voucher for Jump the Gun, I think.
I think he's a part of, he's a very sharp sort of mod-looking fella. I can see him either heading into Jump the Gun or Modrafine, I think it's called in Church.
Yeah, Jump the Gun. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a few places in Brighton. I can see him.
Bunker.
Who knows? Maybe he's in those places already.
Well, all we do know is that. We don't know if we've got the game on Boxing Day yet. We'll find out very soon. But all we want to say is Merry Christmas from myself and Al. Thank you to Nick Trepanic, and Merry Christmas to you too. And well, jingly jing.
Hey, jingity jing, it's Dominic the Donkey. Jingity jing, the Italian Christmas donkey. La 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 la. Santa's got a little friend, his name is Dominic, the cutest little donkey you'll never see him kick. When Santa visits his paisans with Dominic, he'll be, because the reindeer cannot climb the hills of Italy. Hey, jingity jing, it's Dominic the donkey. Jingity jing, the Italian Christmas donkey. La 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 la. Jingle bells around his feet and presents on the sled. Hey, look at the Mayor's Derby on top of Dominic's head. A pair of shoes for Louis and a dress for Josephine. The
label on the inside says they're made in Brooklyn. Hey, jingity jing, it's Dominic the donkey. Jingity jing, the Italian Christmas donkey. La 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 la. Children sing and clap their hands, and Dominic starts to dance. They talk Italian to a man he even understands. Cumbaras and cumbaras do they dance a tarantella. When Santa Nicola comes to town and brings a chucharilla. Hey, jingity jing, it's Dominic the donkey. Jingity jing, the Italian Christmas donkey. La 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 la. La 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 dee da.
Hey, Dominic, what another dollar?